Welcome to the Visegrad Insight podcast from Central Europe on Central Europe.
It's the 29th of May, 2022. I'm Miles Maftian, editorial director here at Visegrad Insight. I'm sitting with Adam Yaseb, deputy managing editor. Adam, you and I, and the whole team, we're back in Warsaw now after an intense few days in Conversano, Italy, where we gathered over 30 of CEE's thought leaders for a foresight exercise on the future of the EU parliamentary elections. It was a great time. The goal was to essentially create a strategic foresight plan that would navigate the future challenges and the opportunities that might impact the 2024 EU parliamentary elections. I think it was a good step in the right direction for our listeners. If you want to learn a bit more about it, you can click the link in the description and follow along with the updates that we have for the project. Now, on to the pressing issues for the region this week. Let's start with what happened over the weekend in Turkey. Who better to ask than you, Adam? So we saw that Erdogan defeated the opposition in the second round, and this essentially cemented his grip on the country. So what now? How is Turkey going to fare under his rule?
Well, first of all, I'm probably not the best person to ask, as I'm not based in Turkey. However, I have been following Turkey closely for a number of years, and it seems to me that, you know, as we predicted in our reporting from the first round, Erdogan managed to stage a comeback. He was trailing in opinion polls, and yet he clinched a victory. I think it just shows how strong his hold on the country is and how powerful his rhetoric about making Turkey great again, if you will, resonates with voters despite economic hardships and despite the fact that the economic situation is unstable. For the majority of Turks, it seems he's still seen as a sort of father figure, someone who can guarantee Turkey's position in the world. You know, his brand of nationalism with harsh rhetoric and control of the institutions, of different institutions and the media, has given him an advantage. Now, the future, as they say sometimes about forecasting, you know, forecasting is particularly difficult when it deals with the future. The caveat is it's highly speculative. But what we might expect is that Erdogan will struggle mostly on the economic arena. You know, the economy is not in a recession, it's still growing, but inflation remains stubbornly high, and Turkey's dependence on Russia's gas deliveries is huge. So Erdogan has to navigate this somehow to avoid a complete meltdown of the economy. We will see how that plays out, but that sort of limits his space for maneuver. He also needs to navigate between different interests of Turkey on the global stage. We know NATO is important to him. Relationship with the US is important to him, despite sometimes his own rhetoric. And at the same time, he's keeping an open line to Putin. He's certainly flirting with China. So he's navigating. He's navigating between these different conflicting objectives and the conflicting scenarios. Given less space on the economic area, I think there is a chance he will behave a little bit more reasonably in his third term. Now that his power is secure, for democracy in Turkey, this is a bad result. It can cement some of the autocratic tendencies there and limit civil society. But Turkey is an important player, and certainly the Biden administration is not going to risk its other global objectives, particularly in the context of the war in Ukraine, by trying to isolate Turkey, for example. So they will put a brave face on it, and they will try to reach an accommodation with Erdogan.
Well, I have to say, I think in CEE, when it comes to elections, we're going to be in this constant roller coaster this year, because it started with such a bright light in Czechia with Petr Pavel, right? And then you move on to Bulgaria, you realize that it's still the same sort of discontent, growing discontent there, not only of the people themselves and the situation they find themselves in, but even politically with their choices. And now we see and we look ahead towards what's going to happen with Slovakia and Poland. So it's going to be an interesting year, that's for sure.
It's a paradox, because it seems that Russia's aggression on Ukraine has worked differently on the Central and Eastern Europe than it did on the Western part of the continent, which is a paradox because, in fact, Central Europeans were right about Russia. And obviously, some of the Western European partners were wrong about Russia in principle. And so you could say the sort of Western societies have been sobering up from this and drawing conclusions, and support for Ukraine is firm, and also support for mainstream parties is pretty strong in the West. And in the East, the sense of being right and the disappointment in, let's say, Germany's attitude to, I don't know, Nord Stream 2 or relationship with Russia sort of fueled, paradoxically fueled forces which are ideologically more aligned with Turkey's approach to democracy, or even Russia's approach to sort of nationalistic identity politics and culture wars. So this is the paradox that it seems that in Central Europe, instead of strengthening the mainstream, Russia's war on Ukraine is, if you take for a second, if you park the defense component, the security component, if you look just at the politics and the democratic dynamic, it seems that Central Europe is slipping, as if some of these leaders were saying, look, you know, democracy failed, and we need a strong hand on the tiller. Again, the paradox of it is that this is exactly the kind of argument that Putin would use.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are those, especially Viktor Orban and others, who would say it in a different way. They say that, oh, we're just rewriting the liberal script. We're all for democracy. We're all for participation.
Their understanding of democracy is different from what we understand as democracy, because they are talking of a majoritarian rule. So
exactly.
They're basically saying, if I get a mandate from society, I can do whatever I want.
Yep.
And there are no checks and balances. And of course, this is on the ideological sort of level, but then they are also taking concrete steps to undermine the opposition's ability to win power at a future date. So they basically, instead of a level playing field, they're rigging the system to maintain an advantage. And this is what happened in Turkey. This is what happened in Russia, as a matter of fact, over the past 15 years. And we see this happening in Serbia. In Poland, we have developments which we are going to go into detail later, also on this podcast. But this is all worrisome.
Yeah, absolutely. Speaking of Hungary, there was some news. And once again, it's always a bit of an opera when it comes to anything related to Hungary. But this time, you know, the European Parliament is considering what some people believe to be a bold proposal. We can talk about that. I wanted to ask you specifically if you think it's bold and so forth. But the point here is that this could potentially reshape Hungary's role, you know, within the EU. So Hungary might be stripped of its EU presidency, which is scheduled for the second half of 24. And of course, a lot of people say that this is a response for the concerns related to the rule of law, but also let's think it could be also about their controversial decisions to veto sanctions against Russia and support Ukraine. So look, here and for the 6-7 years that I've lived in Hungary, I've monitored the Hungarian situation, the actions there, the growing concerns of state of democracy, the rule of law. We know all of this. And some might suggest that this move to revoke the presidency sends the strong message, right, that the EU is taking these issues seriously and so forth. But it's interesting because it's also worth noting that there are some sources who are essentially saying, look, if you do this, what does it do? It essentially just does, it plays right into Orban's narrative. Into the narrative of allowing him to portray his country as this victim of Brussels oppression. And, you know, this could in turn, like, eventually even influence next year's EP election. So, of course, there's a delicate balance. But even for me, it's more this matter of, does this really do anything to kind of change the rule of law situation in Hungary? No, not necessarily. I mean, we don't really think that this is going to make Orbán change his ways. So what is going on here? A sign of solidarity that there needs to be this sort of unity towards the liberal principles, liberal actions here? I mean, how do we even break this down? Because I'm just skeptical either way if we were to do this.
Right. No, I share your sentiment. I think it's a symbolic gesture. We hear it may be a resolution of the European Parliament, but, you know, it's not binding for the European Council. There may be voices in the European Council, there may be heads of states who will say, yes, let's do that, but I'm pretty sure that there will be others saying, let's not do this for the reasons you mentioned. I think money talks. You know, I think the key issue here is for the EU to be consistent in all matters relating to financing the Orbán government in view of its of its clear breach of the treaties, but also regarding the calls on Russia and being the constant sort of thorn in the back of its partners. Because one thing that distinguishes Hungary from other Central and Eastern European countries when it comes to problems in general with some of the issues we discussed earlier is that Hungary, on top of everything else, is now the single EU ally of Vladimir Putin, making it more difficult to coordinate. And in the background, as you remember, we run this piece by Wojciech Przypylski, our editor-in-chief, showing how Poland and Hungary, which were united in challenging the EU system of values and tried to stage a cultural revolution inside the EU, actually their paths diverged over Ukraine. So Hungary is really isolated, and it's a bit of a self-isolation. But I would not give Orbán further pretext or different grounds to launch his tirades against the EU. So it's better to stick to what the EU is good at, namely, you know, all the court rulings and proceedings that just take longer, but they're happening. There's a question of how money is going to be disbursed, if at all, and so on and so forth. So to me, this is the correct path.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Let the battle of narratives actually play out in the EU arena itself through this presidency. Maybe at least then, with Hungary and in the EU presidency, maybe we'll get actually quite an interesting debate, as opposed to just sidelining this and having this oppositional us against everyone sort of rhetoric that we get out of Hungary.
Yeah, and there is another factor, which is that, you know, it's the presidency will take place shortly after the elections, European Parliament elections, and frankly, the presidency agenda is not going to be very rich, to put it mildly.
Absolutely. So right now we're going to move on. Wojciech Przybylski will actually explain his latest piece that came out today, how a potential new Polish law targeting Russian interference can threaten democratic security.
Polish Parliament has adopted a law now signed by the Polish president to install a Russian influence investigative commission, parliamentary body that would have administrative right to actually suspend civil liberties, civil rights of people suspected of Russian influence. It would be quite a normal thing to have in any country in Europe and in the transatlantic space to investigate such connections. However, in Poland, this is going to be used specifically for the electoral campaign and on false pretense against the opposition, which is now gaining some ground in the upcoming elections. The PIS government, right-wing government that has been backsliding in terms of rule of law, now is on a full swing attack by political innovation against the democratic setup to undermine the votes of the people in elections that are upcoming this October. Mr. Kaczyński, leader of the government, of the governing party Law and Justice, has already numerously repeated that the opposition, and specifically the leader of the opposition, Donald Tusk, has been siding with Russian interests, as if already declaring that Donald Tusk is to be found guilty by the commission, and with no rights to appeal in the court, he will be suspended, or he will the suspicion on him will deem him unfit for the office and would gain some electoral ground for PIS. In the shadow of these proceedings, in the shadow of what has happened, there is a second layer of actual interests of the foreign powers hostile to the democratic setup in Poland and in NATO countries. As the letter of the U.S. ambassador to Poland, Mr. Mark Brzezinski, revealed on Friday shows, there is a genuine concern that the upcoming legislation, in parallel to the one that I just explained, may serve the foreign powers to take over some of the critical infrastructure. So that includes Russian and China interests. That also in the past, in a couple of instances, the PIS government was not shy to, if not support, then at least enable in Poland. Underline and underscore that a few months into the war, into the full-scale invasion of Russia into Ukraine, the Polish government was still reluctant to seize assets of Russian citizens, including those blacklisted on sanction lists. And only after public calling, including my own in April last year on social media and on Twitter, appealing directly to the government to do something about it, because Belgium and Netherlands were already way ahead of Poland, the government started to prepare some of its internal action. So the shadow, the long shadow of Kremlin is clearly visible in today's activity, both in the real interest, core economic influence on Polish soil, and at the same time, it is visible through the very practice of establishing such a commission, which is nothing else but a Soviet-style whataboutism.